हरि ॐ सहनावतु सहनाभुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सवि गौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे।
Chuck, one of the devotees in the storefront invited me upstairs to see the Swami in private. I was led out of the storefront into a hallway and suddenly into a beautiful little garden with a picnic table, a bird bath, a bird house, and flower beds. After we passed through the gardens, we came to a middle-class apartment building. We walked up the stairs and entered an apartment which was absolutely bare of any furniture. Just white walls and a parquet floor. He led me through the front door and into another room, and there was the Swami, sitting in that same majestic spiritual presence on a thin cotton mat, which is covered by a cloth with little elephants printed on it, and leaning back on a pillow which stood against the wall. One night, Bruce walked home with Wally, and he told Wally about his interest in going to India and becoming a professor of Oriental literature. "Why go to India?" Wally asked. "India has come here. Swamiji is teaching us these authentic things. Why go to India?" Bruce thought Wally made sense. So he resolved to give up his long-cherished idea of going to India, at least as long as he could go on visiting the Swami. "Bruce, I decided to go and speak personally to Swamiji, so I went to the storefront. I found out that he lived in an apartment in the rear building. A boy told me the number and said I could go and speak with the Swami. He said, 'Yes, just go.' So I walked through the storefront, and there was a little courtyard where some plants were growing. Usually in New York, there is no courtyard, nothing green. But this was very attractive. And in that courtyard, there was a boy typing at a picnic table, and he looked very spiritual and dedicated. I hurried upstairs and rang the bell for apartment number 2C. After a little while, the door opened, and it was the Swami. 'Yes,' he said, and I said, 'I would like to speak with you.' He opened the door wider and stepped back and said, 'Yes, come.' We went inside together into his sitting room and sat down facing each other. He sat behind his metal trunk desk on a very thin mat, which was covered with a woolen blanket-like cover that had frazzled ends and elephants decorating it. He asked me my name, and I told him it was Bruce. And then he remarked, 'Ah, in India during the British period, there was one Lord Bruce.' And he said something about Lord Bruce being a general and engaged in some campaigns. I felt that I had to talk to the Swami, to tell him my story, and I actually found him interested to listen. It was very intimate, sitting with him in his apartment, and he was actually wanting to hear about me. While we were talking, he looked up past me, high up on the wall behind me, and he was talking about Lord Chaitanya. The way he looked up, he was obviously looking at some picture or something. but with an expression of deep love in his eyes. I turned around to see what made him look like that. Then I saw the picture in the brown frame, Lord Chaitanya dancing in kirtan. Inevitably, meeting with Prabhupada meant a philosophical discussion. Chuck, I asked him, can you teach me Raja Yoga? Oh, he said, here is Bhagavad Gita. He handed me a copy of the Gita. Turn to the last verse of the sixth chapter, he said, and read. I read the translation out loud. And of all yogis, he who is worshipping me with faith and devotion, I consider to be the best. I could not comprehend what faith and devotion meant, so I said, sometimes I am getting some light in my forehead. That is hallucination, he said. So abruptly he said it, although he did not strain his person. The words came at me so intensely that it completely shocked me. Raja means king, king yoga, he said. But this is emperor yoga. So he's establishing that the yoga for the devotional service, that's the highest of all yogas, right? So you have so many yogas, so many different levels. But the highest then will be this yoga in connection with Krishna consciousness, right? That would be the best. Because yoga means to connect to the Supreme. So all these others are connecting at levels down on the Brahman level, the Paramatma level, but none of them actually connect at the Bhagavan level, the actual, you know, Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, right? Even the yogis are meditating on Paramatma. They don't actually get to the point where Krishna is a person, that you interact with Krishna as a person. I know that he had attained such a high state not using chemicals from a laboratory or any Western speculative process. And this was certainly what I wanted. Are you giving classes? I asked. He said, yes. If you come at 6 in the morning, I am giving class in the Gita, and bring some flower or fruit for the deity. I looked into the adjoining room, which was bare with a wooden parquet floor, bare walls and a tiny table. And on the table was a picture of 5 human-like figures with their arms raised above their heads. Somehow their arms and faces were not like any mortal I had ever seen. I knew that the picture was looking at me. When I came out on the street in front of the storefront, there were a few people standing around and I said, I don't think I'm going to take LSD anymore. I said it out loud to myself, but some other people heard me. Steve, I wanted to show my appreciation for spiritual India, right? So in other words, those who are sincere, they were dealing with all these drugs and that because they were trying to find spiritual life. So when they actually come in contact with it, then they can see this is so much far superior. So then they're comfortable with it and they say they won't get involved in these things anymore. But unfortunately, those who some say they're taking it, and the idea is spiritual, but it's not. So therefore, when they come in contact with Prabhupada, they still don't want to give it up or anything. Right? Steve, I wanted to show my appreciation for spiritual India. So I presented to Swamiji that I had read the autobiography of Gandhi. It was glorious, I said. What is glorious about it? Swamiji challenged. When he asked us, there were others present in the room. Although I was a guest, he had no qualms about challenging me for having said something foolish. Right. Means, in other words, probably we're discussing the absolute truth, so he didn't have any problem saying to people that this is wrong. Right? He wasn't thinking, oh, he's a guest, how can you say like this? It was a matter of, you know, this is not correct spiritually. He's a teacher, and, you know, they are students, they don't know. I searched through my remembrances of Gandhi's autobiography to answer his challenging question. What is glorious? I began to relate that one time Gandhi as a child, although raised as a vegetarian, was induced by some of his friends to eat meat. And that night he felt that a lamb was howling in his belly. Swamiji dismissed this at once, saying, most of India is vegetarian. That is not glorious. I couldn't think of anything else glorious to say. And Swamiji said, His autobiography is called Experiments with Truth. But that is not the nature of truth. It is not to be found by someone's experimenting. Truth is always truth. Right? Because people think, well, I'll find the truth. I'll work it out. I'll move it this way and that way, and then I'll find what it is. But it's not Krishna is always Krishna. The truth is truth. So it's a matter of hearing about the truth from authority. Right? Because we're not going to actually, through our senses, be able to work it out. Although, so Steve, still continuing with Steve speaking. Although it was a blow to my ego, being exposed and defeated by Swamiji seemed to be a gain for me. I wanted to bring before him many different things for his judgment, just to see what he had to say about them. I showed him the paperback edition of the Bhagavad Gita that I was reading and carrying in my back pocket. He perused the back cover. There was a reference to the eternal faith of the Hindus, and Swamiji began to take the phrase apart. He explained how the word Hindu was a misdemeanor and does not occur anywhere in the Sanskrit literature itself. He also explained that Hinduism and Hindu beliefs were not eternal. Right? Because Hindu means coming from the Sindhu River. Right? But in these Middle Eastern languages, they can't say H's, excuse me, they can't say S's. The S is always turned into a guttural, like that sound. So then the Sindhu River, saying it for them in their language, it comes out Hindu, like that, you understand? And then other people don't use that guttural sound, so then they'll soften it, so then the Hindu becomes Hindu, you understand? So it's just something from the Muslim community. You had the Sindhu River. On the other side lived those who followed the Vedas. So those were, you know, the Sindhus, you know, like that. You know, they're on the other side of the Sindhu River. They're the Sindhus. So that's what they were trying to say. But somehow it comes out Hindu. So that makes sense. So he's saying it's not. Plus, their beliefs aren't eternal because they're just dealing with the mundane and being good, be nice, you know, get up to the, enjoy the heavenly planets, or, you know, detach yourself from the world, come to the Brahman platform, but then you one will come back from there, back to the material world. So it's all temporary. They're not preaching Vaishnavism, right? Because Vaishnavas won't call themselves Hindus, right? They'll say that they're Vaishnavas. So if anybody says they're Hindu, means they're preaching forms of the eternal religion, but they're not getting any eternal benefit because they don't know the eternality of it. They don't know its connection to the Lord. That's what makes it eternal. Right? So when activities and knowledge are connected to Krishna, then it becomes eternal. But when they're not, then it's always temporary. Bruce, after I talked about my desire for religious life, I began telling him about a conflict I had with one of my professors in English literature. He was a Freudian, so he would explain the characters in all the novels and so on in a Freudian context with Freudian terminology. Everything was sexual, the mother for the son, this one for that one, and so on. But I would always see it in terms of a religious essence. I would see it in terms of a religious impulse or some desire to understand God. I would write my papers in that context, and he would always say, the religious can also be interpreted as Freudian. So I didn't do very well in the course. I was mentioning this to the Swami, and he said, your professor is correct. I was surprised. I'm going to an Indian Swami, and he is saying that the professor was correct, that everything is based on sex and not religion. This kind of pulled the rug out from under me when he said that. Then he qualified what he said. He explained in the material world, everyone is operating on the basis of sex. Everything that everyone is doing is being driven by the sex impulse. So, he said, Freud is correct. Everything is on the basis of sex. Then he clarified what material life is and what spiritual life is. In spiritual life, there's a complete absence of sex desire. So this had a profound effect on me. He wasn't confirming my old sentimental ideas, but he was giving me new ideas. He was giving me his instructions, and I had to accept them. Talking to the Swami was very nice. I found him completely natural, and I found him to be very artistic. The way he held his head, the way he enunciated his words, very dignified, very gentlemanly, right? So this refinement was always appreciated like that. And so, yeah. And then, yeah. So here is that the Freudian aspect we'll see later is also, the Prabhupada says, Freud is, you know, is crazy. But, because Freud was he's basically seen as the, you know, the father of Western psychology and all that. But unfortunately, his seeing that everything's based on this desire, you know, this material desire, he's not actually seeing even that in the proper light. He even gets that perverted. And so then, you know, Prabhupada, you know, just said that he's basically a little weird. So that's the thing, it's material desire. So religiousness here in the material world still is based on material desire. You know, people want to do good work, go to the heavenly planets, enjoy themselves. The idea that they're going to please God and then go to the spiritual world, that's generally not part of any religious process. No one's talking. So they don't actually come to the transcendental platform. You know, so Prabhupada was taking what he was saying and then taking it to a further step so he could understand it. You know, not just playing with it and saying it was okay. You know, you encourage by taking what they're doing further, not by just saying it's okay, you know, unless it actually is. The boys found Swamiji not only philosophical, but personal also. Steve, a few nights later, I went to see the Swami and told him I was reading his book. One thing that had especially caught my attention was a section where the author of Srimad Bhagavatam, Vyasadeva, was admitting that he was feeling despondent. Then his spiritual master, Narada, explained that his despondency had come because he had written so many books. Although he had written so many books, he had neglected to write in such a way as to fully glorify Krishna. After hearing this, Vyasadeva compiled the Srimad Bhagavatam. When I read this, I identified with the fact that Vyasadeva was a writer, because I considered myself a writer also, and I knew that I was also despondent. This was very interesting about the author, Vyasadeva, I said. He wrote so many books, but still he was not satisfied, because he had not directly praised Krishna. Although I had very little understanding of Krishna consciousness, Swamiji opened his eyes very wide, surprised that I was speaking on such an elevated subject from the Srimad Bhagavatam. He seemed pleased. Because Vyasadeva has written so many things, but in his writing, he hasn't, like this, as Prabhupada said, directly praised. Yeah, to fully glorify Krishna. So he's glorifying here and there. But to bring it out that this is it, this is the conclusion of everything, this is the only method, this is the ultimate, you know, process of elevation and realization, that he doesn't say in the Mahabharata and other places. Though he mentions Krishna and glorifies Krishna, so a smart person may understand that and come to that conclusion. But the problem is most people aren't smart. You know, they may be intelligent materially to be able to work with the material energy and get done what they want to do. But to actually be smart enough to come to the conclusion about who God is, that most don't have. So therefore, that's why he's despondent, because the Lord is not satisfied. Because the living entities that will read his literature still won't become God conscious, which is the purpose of the Vedic literature. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam directly glorifies the Lord and makes it very obvious that this is the only process. Then he's satisfied. Right? So Steve then read this all very nicely, and now he's contemplating that and is impressed by it. And so when he's speaking this to Prabhupada, Prabhupada is also very impressed that here this, you know, Western, you know, New York Walla is able to appreciate all this, you know, because up to now they're all just talking all this. Well, you know, I was thinking, and you know, about the whole and the complete, and you know, and that, you know, the wherefores and the whyfores, and you know, and how are we going to, you know, progress, and you know, and then there's, you know, like this, and it's like, you know, what are they saying? They're saying nothing, right? So that's what Prabhupada's been used to up to now, right? Or some questions about India. Oh, yes, I've done yoga like that. You know, so many things. But here someone is actually talking Krishna consciousness straight from the Vedic literature. So Prabhupada is impressed. This seems to be the first time that someone actually spoke, quoted from the books, and actually had some understanding of what was happening. Chuck, I had come by in the afternoon, and Swamiji had given me a plate of prasadam. So I was eating, and a chili burned my mouth. Swamiji said, "Is it too hot?" "Yes," I said. So he brought me a tiny teacup with some milk. And then he took some rice off my plate, and took a piece of banana, and crushed it all up together with his fingers, and said, "Here, eat this. It will kill the action of the chilies." Okay, so rice, bananas with some milk. That's what you use for chilies. Okay? There's so many things you try, it never works, right? You know? Especially water. Why? It doesn't. Bruce, there wasn't anything superficial about it, right? Because it said, like, if you have a fire, if it's a regular fire, you put water, it'll go out, right? But if it's a chemical fire, water won't put it out. So you have to use something else, right? They have all these different kinds of things. So a chili, its fire is from acid, right? It's chemical. So water won't make fire from a chili go away. Does that make sense? It's standard. Bruce, there wasn't anything superficial about him, nor was he ever contrived, trying to make some impression. He was just completely himself. In the Swami's room, there was no furniture, so he sat on the floor. And I found this to be very attractive and simple. Everything was so authentic about him. Uptown at another Swami's place, he sat on a big stuffed living room chairs, and the place had been lavishly furnished. But here was the downtown Swami, wearing simple cloth robes. He had no business suit on. He wasn't covering up a business suit with those saffron robes, and he wasn't affected as the other Swami was, right? So you had the uptown Swami and you had the downtown Swami. So Prabhupada was the downtown Swami, right? So he was more down to earth. The uptown Swami then was, you know, it was all opulent, this, that. Not that that's a problem, but, you know, he's effective. He's just trying to impress you, all this and that. He's trying to do what you're doing, so like this. But Prabhupada was just, you know, this is the way we live, and so that's the way he presented it. What happened there? So I found myself asking him if I could be his student, and he said yes. I was very happy, because he was so different from the other Swami. With the uptown Swami, I was wanting to become a student because I wanted to get something from him. I wanted to get knowledge. I was selfishly motivated, but here I was actually emotionally involved. I was feeling that I wanted to become the Swami's student. I actually wanted to give myself, because I thought he was great, and that what he was giving was pure and pristine and wonderful. It was a sobering balm for the horrible city life. Uptown, I had felt like a stranger, right? So the uptown Swami, you know, he respected him that he had knowledge, but he just wanted to get the knowledge for himself. But with Prabhupada, he wanted to give himself. You understand? So the difference there. Bruce continuing. On one occasion, our conversation turned to my previous trip to India in 1962. And I began talking about how much it meant to me, how much it moved me. I even mentioned that I had made a girlfriend there. Very important. Right? So we got to talking about that. And I told him that I had her picture. I was carrying the girl's picture in my wallet. So Swamiji asked to see. I took out the picture, and Swamiji looked at it and made a sour face and said, "Oh, she is not pretty." Girls in India are more beautiful than that. Hearing that from the Swami just killed my attachment I had for that girl. I felt ashamed that I had an interest in a girl that the Swami did not consider pretty. I didn't ever look at the photograph again, and certainly I never gave her another thought. You know, because Prabhupada's point was, you're dealing with the material energy, you know, then you might as well get, like one sannyasi, he had, given up sannyas and gotten married. And then after some time, Prabhupada saw that sannyasi and the girl. And then Prabhupada turned to one of the other sannyasis and said, "He gave up sannyas for her?" Like that. Bruce was a newcomer and had only been to 1 week of meetings at the storefront, so no one had told him that the members of Ananda Ashram, Dr. Mistra's yoga retreat, had invited Swamiji and his followers for a day in the upside countryside. Bruce had just arrived at the storefront one morning when he heard someone announce, "The Swami is leaving," and Prabhupada came out of the building and stepped into a car. In a fit of anxiety, Bruce thought that the Swami was leaving them for good, for India. "No," Howard told him, "we're going to a yoga ashram in the country." But the other car had already left, and there was no room in Swamiji's car. Just then, Steve showed up. He had expected the boys to come by his apartment to pick him up. They both had missed the ride. Bruce phoned a friend up in the Bronx. That's tough. And convinced him to drive them up to Ananda Ashram. But when they got to Bruce's friend's apartment, the friend decided he didn't want to go. Finally, he lent Bruce his car, and Swamiji's two new followers set out for Ananda Ashram. By the time they arrived, Prabhupada and his group were already taking prasadam, sitting around a picnic table beneath the trees. Ananda Ashram was a beautiful place with sloping hills and lots of trees and sky and green grass and a lake. The two newcomers came walking up to Swamiji, who was eating like the father of a family at the head of a picnic table. Keith was serving from a big wok into the individual plates. When Prabhupada saw his two stragglers, he asked them to sit next to him, and Keith served them. Prabhupada took Steve's chapati and heaped it up with a mound of sugar, and Steve munched on the bread and sugar while everyone laughed. Prabhupada began talking somehow about lion tamers. And he recalled that once at a fair, he had seen a man wrestling with a tiger, rolling over and over with it down a hill. The boys, who rarely heard Swamiji speak anything but philosophy, were surprised. They were delighted, city kids taken to the country by their guru and having a good time. Steve: I was walking with Swamiji across a long, gentle slope. I wanted him to see and approve a picture of Radha and Krishna I had found in a small book, Narada Bhakti Sutra. I had planned to get a color reproduction of it to give to each of his followers. So as we were walking across the grass, I showed him the picture and asked him whether it was a nice picture of Radha and Krishna for reproducing. He looked at the picture, smiled, nodded, and said yes. Bruce: I walked with Swamiji around the grounds. All the others were doing something else, and Swamiji and myself were walking alone. He was talking about building a temple there. Prabhupada walked across the scenic acreage, looking at the distant mountains and forests, and Keith walked beside him. Prabhupada spoke of how Dr. Mishra had offered him the island in the middle of the ashram's lake to build a temple on. "What kind of temple were you thinking of?" Keith asked. "How big?" Prabhupada smiled and gestured across the horizon. as big as the whole horizon. Keith laughed. Yes, Prabhupada replied. Oh, excuse me. Keith laughed. Yes, Prabhupada replied. Oh, okay. A few Ananda Ashram men and women came by. One woman was wearing a sari. Prabhupada turned to the other women and said, "A woman who wears a sari looks very feminine." It was late afternoon when some of Swamiji's followers gathered by the lake and began talking candidly about Swamiji and speculating about his relation to God and their relation to him. "Well," said Wally, "Swamiji never claimed to be God or an incarnation, but he says that he is a servant of God, teaching love of God. But he says that the spiritual master is non-different from God," said Howard. They stood at the edge of the mirrory calm lake and concluded that it was not necessary to talk about this. The answers would be received later. None of them really had much spiritual knowledge, but they wanted their faith to deepen. Afterward, Keith, Wally, and Howard wandered into the meditation room. There was a seat with a picture of Dr. Mishra, who was away in Europe. But the most remarkable thing was a blinking strobe light. "I feel like I'm in a head shop on St. Mark's Place," said Wally. "What kind of spiritual meditation is this?" Howard asked. A Mishra follower wearing a white kurta and white bell bottoms replied that their guru had said they could sit and meditate on the light. "Swamiji says you should meditate on Krishna," said Keith. After sunset, everyone gathered at the large room at the main building to watch a slideshow. It was a loose collection, mostly of assorted slides of India and the Ananda Ashram. A record by a popular Indian sitarist was playing in the background. Some of the slides were of Vishnu temples, and when one slide passed by quickly, Prabhupada asked, "Let me see that. Can you go back? Let me see that temple again." This happened several times when he recognized familiar temples in India. Later in the show, there were several slides of a girl, one of the members of Dr. Mishra's ashram, demonstrating Indian dance poses. As one of her pictures passed, an ashram man joked, "Turn back and let me see that temple again." The jokes seemed at Swamiji's expense and in poor taste. His followers didn't laugh. Then came Swamiji's lecture. He sat up cross-legged on the couch in the largest room in the mansion. The room was filled with people, the Swamiji's followers from the Lower East Side, as well as the Ananda Ashram yogis, sitting on the floor or standing along the walls and in the doorway. He began his talk by criticizing democracy. He said that because people are attached to sense gratification, they vote for a leader who will fulfill their own lust and greed. And that is their only criterion for picking a leader. He went on for 45 minutes to explain about the importance of Krishna consciousness, his reel-to-reel tape recorder moving silently. Then he led a kirtan that bridged all differences and brought out the best in everyone that night. Several nights before in his apartment on 2nd Avenue, Prabhupada had taught his followers how to dance. They had formed a line behind him while he demonstrated the simple step, holding his arms above his head. He would first swing his left foot across the right foot and then bring it back again in a sweeping motion. Then he would swing his right foot over the left and bring it back again. With his arms upraised, Prabhupada would walk forward, swinging his body from side to side, left foot to right side, right foot to left side, in time with the 1-2-3 rhythm. He had shown them that step in regular time and in a slow half-time rhythm. Keith had called it the Swami step, as if it were a new ballroom dance. Prabhupada's followers began dancing, and soon the others joined them, moving around the room in a rhythmic circle of ecstasy, dancing, swaying, sometimes leaping and whirling. It was a joyous hour-long kirtan, And the Swami encouraged everyone to the fullest extent. A visitor to the ashram happened to have his stringed bass with him, and he began expertly turning out his own swinging bass improvisation beneath the Swami's melody, while another man played the tablas. The Ananda ashram members had been divided of late into two tense, standoffish groups. There was the elderly crowd, similar to the old ladies who had attended the Swami's uptown lectures. And there was the young crowd, mostly hip couples. But in the kirtan, their rifts were forgotten and, as they discovered later, even healed. Whether they liked it or not, most all of those present were induced to rise and dance. Then it was late. The Swami took rest in the guest room, and his boys slept outside in their sleeping bags. Howard, I awakened 3 or 4 times, and each time I am flat on my back looking up at the stars, which are always in different positions. My sense of time is confused. The sidereal shifts dizzy me. Sidereal means how the movement of the planets. Then, just before morning, I dream. I dream of devotees clustered about a beautiful golden youth. To see him was to be captivated. His transcendental body radiates an absolute beauty unseen in the world. Stunned, I inquire, who is he? Don't you know, someone says? That's the Swami. I look carefully, but see no resemblance. The youth appears around 18, straight out of Vaikuntha, the spiritual world. If that's Swamiji, I wonder to myself, why doesn't he come to earth like that? A voice somewhere inside me answers, people will follow me for my beauty and not for my teachings. And I awake, startled. The dream is clear in my mind, more like a vision than a dream. I feel strangely refreshed, bathed in some unknown balm. Again I see that the constellations have shifted and that the dimmer stars have faded into the encroaching dawn. I remember Swamiji telling me that although most dreams are simply functions of the mind, dreams of the spiritual master are of spiritual significance. Keith also had a dream that night. Keith, I saw Krishna and Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Arjuna was inquiring from Krishna, and Krishna was reciting the Bhagavad Gita to him. Then that picture phased out, and the images changed. And there was Swamiji, and I was kneeling in front of him. And the same dialogue was going on. I had the understanding that now is the time, and Swamiji is presenting the same thing as Krishna. And we are all in the position of Arjuna. The dream made it very clear that hearing from Swamiji was as good as hearing from Krishna. Right? So dreams are generally just taking things that you've come across in the day and putting them together in some unique patterns like that. So they don't really have anything to do with anything, because the senses aren't connected to the sense objects. So it's not new information, it's just taking old information and mixing it all up. But when it's about the spiritual master, then that's considered to be, that has spiritual significance. Otherwise, other things don't have any meaning. The sun rose over the mountains, streaking the morning sky above the lake with colors. Wally and Keith were walking around the grounds, saying to Prabhupada how beautiful it all was. We are not so concerned with beautiful scenery, said Prabhupada. We are concerned with the beautiful one who has made the beautiful scenery. In other words, Krishna's made the beautiful scenery because he's the most beautiful. So this is just part of his beauty. So we're not so worried about the beautiful scenery as about the one who is the source of that. That's one thing. Time. Okay. Later, Prabhupada sat next to Bruce in the Volkswagen returning to the city. The car went winding around in a ribbon of smooth black mountain road, with lush green forests close in and intermittent vistas of mountains and expansive sky. It was a rare occasion for Bruce to be driving Prabhupada in a car, because none of the Swami's boys had cars. They would always travel by bus or subway. It seemed fitting for the Swami to have a car to ride in, but this was only a little Volkswagen, and Bruce winced whenever they hit a bump and it jostled Prabhupada. As they wound their way on through the mountains, Bruce recalled something he had read in a book by Aldous Huxley's wife about the best places for meditation. One opinion had been that the best place to meditate was by a large body of water, because of the negative ions in the air. And the other opinion that it was better to meditate in the mountains, because you are higher up and closer to God. Okay? Is it better for spiritual realization to meditate in the mountains? Bruce asked. Prabhupada replied, "This is nonsense. There is no question of better place. Are you thinking that God is up on some planet or something and you have to go up higher? No, you can meditate anyway, anywhere. Just chant Hare Krishna." After some time, the drive became tiring for Prabhupada, and he dozed, his head resting forward. Bruce walked with Swamiji up to his apartment, opening the door for him, adjusting the window as he liked it, and preparing things in his room, as if he were the Swami's personal servant. Prabhupada settled back into his second apartment avenue, feeling pleased with the visit to Ananda Ashram. The kirtan had been successful, and one of Dr. Mishra's foremost students had commented that he was impressed by Prabhupada's followers. Simply by chanting, they seemed to be achieving an advanced level of yoga discipline, whereas, quote, "we have more difficulty with all our postures and breath control." Right, so for someone who's serious, because it was, you know, one of his leading students, Dr. Mishra, then they could see that the yoga that's being obtained by Prabhupada's disciples is so much easier and so much more direct, right? And it seems to, and also is that they're, you know, coming to a very advanced level. The United States recently increased involvement in Vietnam. Was creating an increase of opposition to the war. On July 29th, American planes had bombed North Vietnam's two major population centers, Hanoi and Haiphong, an escalation which brought expressions of regret from several allied countries, including Canada, France, and Japan. United Nations Secretary General U Thant openly criticized America's policy in Vietnam. Further opposition to the war ranged from the U.S. Senate down to a newly formed pacifist groups and dissenters held peace marches, sit-ins, and rallies in protest of the war and draft. Means a peace march where everyone goes peacefully and carries signs and different things like that. And then sit-ins is where they just go to some place that, let's say, where these people that are making all these, have some control over this. They'll just go and sit in front of the place on all the steps. There's so many people you can't get in. That's a sit-in. They just, you know, won't. Or at school, they'll sit in. They'll just sit down and won't go to school. You know, they'll just sit there and not do anything. So it kind of, you know, blocks everything. Religious protest was led by Pope Paul VI. And the World Council of Churches decried America's involvement in Vietnam and called for a halt in the fighting as, quote, "the most effective step towards negotiation." On August 6th, the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, there were demonstrations in many major American cities, including a peace vigil at the United Nations headquarters in New York. So a peace vigil would mean they'd all go and just sit out there, so similar like a sit-in. But a vigil would generally be at night. They'll put candles and, you know, all these kind of things. On August 31st, there would be another two-week-long peace vigil before the United Nations General Assembly building. And Mr. Larry Bogart had invited Prabhupada and his followers to open the vigil of praying for peace. Larry Bogart, who worked at the United Nations headquarters, had become friends with the Swami and had volunteered his help by arranging to print stationery for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. The letterhead was designed by James Green with a sketch of Radha and Krishna, and Mr. Bogart's name also appeared on the stationery at the head of the list of ISKCON trustees. Prabhupada accepted Mr. Bogart's invitation to the peace vigil. Prabhupada saw it as an opportunity to publicly chant Hare Krishna, so he was glad to attend. He announced to his congregation that Monday, the 31st, instead of the usual morning class at 6:30, everyone should meet at the United Nations headquarters for a special kirtan. August 31st. Some met at the storefront and went by bus, carrying kartals, a tambourine, and the Swami's bongo. Swami rode with a few of his followers in a taxi. The typical dress of his followers consisted of well-worn sneakers, black pants or blue jeans, and t-shirts or button-down sport shirts. Traveling uptown in the early morning put the boys in a light-hearted spirit. And when they saw Swamiji at the UN in his flowering saffron robes, they became inspired. Swamiji began the chanting, but right away the peace vigil organizers stepped in and asked him to stop. This was a silent vigil, so how'd they expect him to talk? They said, and it should have prayerful, nonviolent silence. The boys were crushed, but Swamiji accepted the restriction and began silently chanting on his beads. A dignitary stood up before the assembly and made a short speech in which he mentioned Gandhi and then turned to Prabhupada and indicated he would now speak about peace. Standing erectly, the UN skyscraper looming behind him, Swamiji spoke in a soft voice. The world must accept that God is the proprietor of everything and the friend of everyone, he said. Only then can we have real peace. Mr. Bogart had scheduled the Swami for 2 hours of silent prayer. Prabhupada had the devotees sit together and softly chant japa until their 2 scheduled hours were up. Then they left. As Prabhupada rode back downtown in the heavy morning traffic, he said New York reminded him of Calcutta. Amid the start and stop motion and noise of the traffic, he explained, "We have nothing to do with peace vigils." He simply wanted to spread this chanting of Hare Krishna. That's all. If people take to this chanting, peace will automatically come. Then they won't have to artificially try for peace. Right? Because the peace will come if you're chanting Hare Krishna, you're engaged in activities connected with Krishna, then the peace will come automatically. Right? Because they're trying to find peace separately than Krishna. But the problem is every materialistic living entity has a different idea of how they want to be happy. So there's always going to be fight. You know, about what someone says it should be this way, someone else that way. But if you recognize that Krishna is the center of everything, he's the friend of everyone, everything belongs to him, then you can be peaceful because everyone has to work together to do things in connection to Krishna. They won't be separate from him. September 1st, the New York Post ran a picture of Swamiji's group at the United Nations building. Steve brought the clipping into Prabhupada. "Swamiji, look, they have referred to you here as Swami Krishna." Prabhupada, "Swami Krishna, that's all right." In the picture, some of the boys were sitting with their heads resting on their arms. "Where are you?" Prabhupada asked. Steve pointed. "Oh, you chant like this with your head down?" Like that, you know, like this chanting. Prabhupada had participated in the peace vigil to oblige his contact, Mr. Bogart. Now Mr. Bogart was phoning to offer his appreciation and agreed to visit the storefront. He wanted to help, and he would discuss how the Swami should work with the UN and how he could solicit help from important people for his movement of Indian culture and peace. Prabhupada regarded Mr. Bogart's imminent visit as very important, and he wanted to cook for him personally and receive him in his apartment with the best hospitality. When the day arrived, Prabhupada and Keith cooked together in the small kitchen for several hours. making the best Indian delicacies. Prabhupada posted Stanley downstairs and told him not to allow anyone to come up while he was cooking the feast for Mr. Bogart. Stanley assented, blinking his eyes with his far-off saintly look. Okay. Because this goes into a new story. Okay, end here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaur ki.